Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Don Leeper. He's the founder and I think president of Bookmobile in Minneapolis, or actually in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. Hey, Don, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, David.
Well, thanks for taking some time. I know you're busy. You know, you're running a pretty big digital book printing and distribution business. Maybe you could talk a little bit about Bookmobile. It's B-O-O-K-M-O-B-I-L-E, in case people who are listening want to visit your website, bookmobile.com. You've been going since 1982, but when you started, it was a much smaller business, and I remember you being Stanton Publication Services, basically doing typesetting. Tell me a little bit about how you got to where you are today.
Sure. Well, we started in 1982 when my sister was working at the University of Minnesota Press as a typesetter. They decided to stop doing typesetting in-house. That was an opportunity for us to start a typesetting service. That service expanded during the 80s because people kept asking us to handle book printing as well as book typesetting. And so we sort of became a full-service book design and production house primarily for providing services to university presses and to a lot of literary presses and regional presses.
So when in those earlier years, you weren't printing yourself, though. You were buying print. You were acting as a print buyer for your clients.
Yeah. Because we would sort of be the production department for these small publishers. They would have us buy printing. We bought printing for thousands of books for about 15 years before we did any printing ourselves, actually.
So, and what got you into the idea of being a printer? Because in a way, you know, that's sort of counterintuitive to the model of outsourcing, just because there's so much capital investment involved in printing.
Well, partly just because I'm kind of a geek and I like hardware and software and stuff like that. But the real reason was that I read a article on the opinion page of the St. Paul paper in about 93 or 94, where a guy named David Morris, who's kind of a futurist and thinker, claimed that we'd be going into bookstores and we would order a book from computer screen and it would be printed bound on the spot. And by this point, I'd been buying book printing for 15 years, and I thought, that's baloney. That's never going to happen. But then I started thinking about it, and I was aware of some of the digital technologies that were coming on the scene, and I got very excited about it, actually, and tried to analyze the economics of it. What would it actually look like to put a printing machine and a bindery in a bookstore? And frankly, it didn't look that great. The idea of using digital equipment to print books sort of captivated me at that time. And then later on, after closing down a small publishing house I started with some friends, we were having the dinner celebrating paying off the bank loan, and one of them asked me, well, what about that digital printing thing? And I said, this was 1996. And I said, well, you know, there's issues with it in engaging with the book trade and the way the book trade works. If you could sell books online, I think that would be the trigger for growth in digital book printing. And he said, have you ever heard of this place called Amazon? So I started printing books digitally about 4 months after that.
So, and were you printing on, were you using the Xerox DocuTex?
We started out on a total shoestring. We had, we were doing the design and typesetting work and the print buying. And so we had one person who was working days in the print shop, and I was working nights prepping jobs. And we were using things that were basically just exaggerated laser printers, office laser printers,
right,
at first.
Which is interesting because, you know, back in somewhere a little bit later than that, when Sprout started, their model was to use HP laser printers, off the shelf, high quality, very fast, a series of them linked together so you could really harness the production capability. But the idea was it's much cheaper to buy really good quality, off-the-shelf printing than it is to do specialized printers.
Right. There are some flaws in that thought, but that's kind of how we started out.
Right. So you did that for a while, and now, of course, I fast-forward just on a side note, you've printed 4 million books or more now, I guess. 2009, it says on your website, you printed 4 million. So by now, a couple of years later, you've obviously printed a lot more books.
Yes. We now run 2.5 shifts, so we're running, and sometimes 7 days a week, printing and binding books, both paperbacks and hardcovers now.
Right.
So.
You added hardcovers about 5 or 6 years ago.
Yep.
And what kind of, I mean, how big of an operation, what kind of equipment do you have? How many presses?
We have 5 sheet-fed black and white digital printers and 1 big roll-fed black and white digital printer and 2 color printers.
And what percentage of your printing is color?
Maybe 10%, something like that. That's an area of big opportunity, I think, right now.
Do you think, this is always an issue for, from the publisher's point of view, even though print-on-demand has, or shall we say digital printing, which I think is more accurate, digital printing has lots of advantages. It still has, it changes the cost analysis on a unit basis for the publisher, and it forces different economic behavior, let's say. Color printing digitally has been prohibitively expensive. Do you see that coming down to the point where maybe not children's books that have to sell for $4.99 or $5.99 could be done, but maybe other kinds of books that have higher retail price points could actually work?
The manufacturers of the equipment, Kodak, Xerox, Canon, all know that color book printing is a big opportunity, and they're sinking a lot of R&D dollars into it. Kodak in particular has a device called the Prosper, which is a web-fed 4-color printer, which the first ones just shipped this year, and it the economics of it, at least on the surface, look like they may be able to move the unit cost of printing color books on digital equipment to a place where they work in, selling through the book trade, where you get them where the unit cost is low enough to that you can put a retail price on it that that works, from the consumer's point of view.
And it still can be discounted so that a retailer can buy it and sell it.
Well, yeah, that's a whole other thing is that, so much of it is about returns and getting back to your comment about digital, about unit cost, digital versus offset. In my experience when I was buying offset printing, book printing, I can't tell you how many times publishers would set the press run to get a desirable unit cost, not really factoring in how many are actually going to sell. And experienced publishers, not dummies and not rookies. That was just a mindset. So.
Right. No, but then of course, what you need to do is it, even with with any print run, you have to say, okay, how many am I printing, but how many am I selling? The true cost of the book is the print bill divided by the number of books sold, not the number of books printed.
Absolutely.
But I understand. I take your point. But still, the difficulty. I mean, I guess where I'm going with that question is, and there has been a lot of conversation about this, I think, in recent years about publishers gradually migrating to a direct consumer model. Not all publishers, not every book, but certain kinds of publishers where the opportunities exist for them to build real relationships with consumers, it's possible that for certain books that can only be printed in small quantities digitally, those books, those publishers, those particular audiences may be able to build a new kind of ecosystem which enables you as a publisher to manage the business by going direct to the consumer, because if you have to give a 50% discount on a book that essentially is never going to be returned because it's being sold for a specific, printed for the specific customer who's buying it, the 50% discount doesn't make any sense practically or for the economics of actually making a sale.
That's a really interesting observation. I don't know where this is all headed. When you have, I talk to publishers, clients of ours, where 50% of their sales are through Amazon with, maybe 2 or 3% return rates. And when you have the pressure on physical bookstores, not just from Amazon, but from the growth of ebook sales, at a certain point, the lines cross, and if I don't know what the number is, but if 40% of your books are sold as e-books, 60% as printed books, then your first press run quantities keep going down and down and down.
Right.
Your unit cost goes up regardless of what method you use to print the book. And at a certain point, the whole ecosystem goes through this phase change where it's no longer even possible to sell books on a returnable basis because the numbers don't work at all.
You know? That's right. No, I think the prediction there might be if, you know, supply and demand plays its normal role, then the print books become more expensive because the cost is higher and the number of people buying them is smaller.
Right.
So the cost must necessarily rise, which, of course, has a negative feedback effect. You know, as the cost goes up, fewer people buy the print books. More people are seeing the e-book as, if it's purely economic, more people are going to buy the e-book because it's at a lower price, and fewer people buy print books, thus potentially driving the cost even higher.
And that ripples down not just through the print unit cost, but through maintaining infrastructure to support the printed book value chain.
That's
warehouses,
right.
Trucking, distributors, wholesalers, the whole thing is affected drastically by those changing equations.
Right, although some of it could be improved by changes in those equations, particularly in the return side. I mean, the pressure may not be felt in the university press world in quite the same way, but it seems to me that ultimately retail have to go to a system where the books are, it's always a one-way ship, and the books, if they don't sell, are going to be marked down with the publisher sharing the markdown with the retailer, and then ultimately they're remaindered in place. That seems to me the ultimate end game of what we're talking about, that books, whether they're sold to consumers directly or whether they're sold to retailers to resell, ultimately the returns equation has to change.
Yes, I would agree.
And especially in digital printing. And as you say, you know, kind of rethinking the whole supply chain becomes necessary. Well, let's talk a little bit about e-books because that you've brought that up. I guess as a natural outgrowth of being involved in the value chain for publishers in terms of production, I'm assuming you felt the need to become educated in e-books and how they are created and then distributed, and that got you into that business a couple of years ago.
Well, it's sort of. The reason I became interested in digital printing was because I had seen when we started out typesetting, we were using dedicated typesetting equipment that cost $100,000, blah, blah, blah. And within the space of a year and a half or 2 years, all that equipment was made obsolete by a Macintosh and PageMaker. And so I saw what happened when digital entered an economic space. And then that moved downstream. So first the typesetters were put out of business, or they changed their business drastically. Then it moved into the preparation area of printing houses, and then the litho strippers and litho camera operators became obsolete. I could see that this march was just going to continue until the logical extension of that is that you're not printing anything, you're looking at something on a screen. So from the very beginning, when we started digital printing, it was with the thought that this was going to be a complement to whatever the final digital form was. In 2000, which was sort of the first era of e-books, you know, 1999, 2000, where there was a lot of buzz, there was, of course, lots of dot-com dollars around, and we created an e-book startup company to create books in a way that you could easily prepare them for printing, prepare them for different flavors of e-books, different formats. And we burned up a lot of venture capital money and too much of my own, and then the e-book market never materialized back then, which was fairly demoralizing at that point. When Kindle was launched in late 2007, I bought one immediately. I read a lot, which is really the reason I'm in this business. I bought one, and the compelling thing was the bookstore in the device itself, the wireless bookstore. And it became quite apparent that Jeff Bezos had put together the necessary ingredients to catalyze the market, which it did. And so we restarted our ebook services in 2008, and we're now And so we make turnbooks into ebooks, and we distribute ebooks now.
And do you outsource, as many of the conversion companies do? Are you outsourcing that work to less expensive venues, shall we say?
Well, we started out doing it all in-house. We quickly got completely backlogged, and naturally enough, there was resistance internally to outsourcing it. But frankly, we got to a point where we couldn't get it all done. And so we do have a relationship with an Indian conversion house, and they do a pretty good job. But just as in a way, and this is kind of a hard sell to publishers, but I think with experience maybe they'll get it, but in the way that when you wouldn't take first pages you get from a compositor and send it right to the printer, we validate, we check all the conversions in-house now, and we know how to make them so we can fix them and tweak them. And because we're distributors, we know that you can send 100 EPUBs to Barnes & Noble and they work fine, send the same ones to Overdrive or to Apple, and they'll kick them back and say that they don't work and you got to do something a little different with them. So it's kind of a body of experience that we built up since 2008.
Right. I think that's actually going to be a value that, you know, for that particular role. I mean, I've talked to a lot of writers who've, you know, a lot of writers are seeing the opportunity to self-publish through Kindle and Nook. And but it's not as simple as anybody says it is, and there are issues that they are just simply not aware of, in the same way that a lot of writers who felt at one point that, it, you know, you could just print books if you, you know, you could compose them in Microsoft Word. Why not? You know, it's not good, but it doesn't work. I mean, it gets you pretty ugly books. And I think there is a role for the kind of design production functionality that represents both care and quality, but also experience and understanding of the rules of reading. I mean, that's what book design is really about, is understanding the relationship between the human eye and the page.
Absolutely. Am I allowed to rant, David?
Oh, sure. That's what this is. This would be great. Rants
okay.
are good.
I read constantly, right? So I read like probably 4 books a week, and most of the time now they're e-books. The level of quality in e-books is so abysmal. It's the kind of quality that would have gotten any typesetter fired 20 years ago. I mean, they wouldn't even been let in the door. Reading a book right now from a major publisher where there is some kind of typo or just excruciating formatting issue every 3 or 4 pages. The system has gotten completely out of whack, where gray care is lavished on pre-creating the print pages, and then it's, you know, the conversion is done, and it's botched, basically. And this is not, I don't think this is purely an aesthetes issue, because I was on, I know a guy named Vince Flynn who writes thrillers. And so I was just curious, I was looking on the Kindle on the reviews of his latest book, and people were kind of irked about the fact that apparently his publisher's gone to the agency model, so now it's $12.99 or whatever. But what the interesting thing to me was, they were saying it's $12.99 and it's full of typos. You know, this is just crazy. It's crazy.
Well, I think there's actually a big danger there, because if you are trying to build a market and try to attract people, you'll get people who will read regardless of mistakes. But I've published books where I've made mistakes that readers have complained about, and in today's world, readers can complain publicly. So if you publish a really crappy ebook, and people are reading it on Kindle or Nook or whatever, all they have to do is go post their comment and give you 1 star.
Right.
And those star ratings are actually more important than people realize. They affect your ability. They affect your display in search, and then and where you come out in the hierarchy of book display on screen. So a really terribly produced book will be trashed by readers and won't be found by other readers, which may be actually, kind of Darwinianly a good thing. But it also is really bad for the business. And
I think it's terrible for the business. And, Amazon blames the publishers, rightly so, I think. It's just like, how are we going to maintain the perceived value of the book if the production values are shoddy? It's not going to happen,
Right. Well, but then there is the other issue, too, and that is publishers and everybody involved in selling ebooks need to take a position about value and quality. And, you know, pre-press doesn't go away. I mean, I know there's, you know, we could endlessly go over the arguments about the pricing of ebooks, and which I'm not actually interested in here today, but I think that publishers know that their responsibility editorially doesn't change, and pre-press and production still occurs in an ebook. And so that gets me to a question point that I want to ask you. And this is sort of, there's a two sides to the question. I try to not ask you a multi-part question. Do you see in the evolution of publishing, as we talked about before, you know, at some point more ebooks, more books will be published initially as ebooks, not as print first, but as digital first. And I'm really interested in this question because from a production point of view, I think pure E is very different from pure P. And if you focus on producing an ebook, the question is, do you need to include the opportunity or the option to have a print book from it, or is it going to eventually become a sort of situation where it's reversed? We now have, when we talk about it even, we say, I'm doing a conversion to E. Maybe if we start with an ebook, you would do a conversion to P.
Well, I'm not sure which question to answer.
I know, that was all over the place, and I'm sorry.
But I think it's very probable that certain categories of books will be published as e-only or e-first and print for those who prefer it. I think other categories of book may never go e. Or if they go e, they'll go e in a form that supports design values. You know. So I'm not sure where it's headed, except that I do think that there's and speaking as a consumer here, there's especially the reading public, which is, you know, any public has a sense of quality. And I think that in the long run, that's got to be brought back up. Right now we're in the situation where we have ebooks are the lowest common denominator, and they render this way on the Nook, and that way on Kindle, and that way on the Sony, and that way on iBooks, and so on and so forth. And I think that is devaluing the book from the reader's experience point of view, not from some design maven's point of view. I don't know if I answered the question.
Yeah, no, I think that's my question was actually it wasn't really well put. But let's move into the electronic publishing realm a little bit. One of the things that you've done recently that has gotten a lot of attention, I was particularly interested in, is this program you've called Ampersand. And maybe, you know, what you were addressing there is the difficulty that poetry has had in the electronic environment for composition reasons, if nothing else. But I think Ampersand is more than just a composition tool. Maybe you could talk about it.
Well, Ampersand actually arose because, just a little rewind here, we develop apps that are based on books as well. So we've been doing that for about a year. Ampersand is derived from frustration I had last fall when we had a whole series of books where the publisher really wanted to make them into e-books, and what we came up with was that basically design was an integral part of the value of the book, and to bust up the book and put it into an EPUB was pointless. One book in particular is called I, Hotel by Karente Yamashita, which was a National Book Award finalist. It has poetry sections in it, has dance notation in it, images. The book is obviously part of the appeal of this book is not just the words or the images, but the way they're composed on the page. And we attempted in several different ways to render that into an ebook, and finally came to the conclusion that it wasn't doable. So with that in mind, and we do work for a lot of poetry publishers. So we've been hearing for some years that, okay, ebooks are fine for the novels, for the nonfiction. What are we going to do about poetry? And the question just persisted because really there's no way to put poetry in a responsible fashion into a refillable ebook. And now there may be some recent changes with Apple's so-called fixed format,
right, with their anchoring
page layout,
right,
EPUB.
Right.
But I'll get back to that in a second. So what we did was say, look, the designer, the poet, has gone to all this trouble to compose these poems on the page beautifully, and we have these new devices called tablets, which can quite adequately represent those pages as they were printed on their screens. So let's start with the print PDFs, and we wrap programming around the print PDFs and display those on a page, and we do programming so that that you can enlarge the type by rotating the screen and it'll automatically enlarge. You can enlarge any piece of type infinitely by doing the hand gesture thing. And it works pretty well, and we took it around to publishers, and they said, well, maybe this will do it. Maybe this is the answer, and they've been very pleased so far. Of course, we'll be launching this summer. It's going to be a long road between now and then, but I think this is maybe one solution. Getting back to the fixed layout EPUBs, okay, so you do all this stuff. You bust up a book into a reflowable ebook, and then you refix the layout? That's crazy. I mean, excuse me, but that's why not just put the PDF up there? And that's been the complaint from some EPUB people is that, well, it's just another way to present a PDF, essentially, which, except that in my view, it's an inferior way because you don't have the control with CSS, et cetera, and HTML that you do with InDesign or Quark Express. So.
Well, and so let me ask you a little bit more about Ampersand. So is Ampersand a tool that a publisher will, or that you will use if a publisher gives you a file that wants to retain its particular layout, or is this something that the publishers will either buy or license from you and do their own production with?
Well, the way we've conceived of it is we want to, we're focused on the poetry market, which is not a large market, but maybe it's the right scale for our scale company. I don't know. So Ampersand is a free reading app, much like there's the free Kindle app for the iPad, the free Barnes Noble reading app for the iPad, and there will be for the Android tablets as well, I'm sure. So the app is free. We have a website where we actually sell poetry books, and that you can link to the website from within the app. You can do the typical things. You can the limited browsing of the books, and you can buy the books from the website, and they automatically load into the app for reading. So.
Got it. So it's essentially, it's like a, I mean, I call it an, it's a reader. It's an app reader.
Yes. Yes.
Like Stanza was or is.
Yes.
So you'll make that available to anybody who wants it, and then they can buy from within the app, or they can buy on other at other places as well.
Well, they can buy, I'm sure you're aware of the issues going on with
yes.
Apple and in-app purchase.
Yes, that whole question is.
And this has kind of been a little bit of a maybe a rain cloud over Ampersand a little bit, but we think it's still quite viable. But we're kind of waiting for the dust to settle, to mix a bunch of wet and dry metaphors there. The books, it looks like the books will have to be available through in-app purchase, and we may or may not make them available. From a website as well. I think we probably will do both because we anticipate selling printed poetry books as well as the
right.
ebook poetry.
So you'll want to have a website. Now, well,
yeah.
So that then I guess the other question is when you, as the reader, as the proprietor of the reader, you have to give Apple 30% of the sale. I assume you'll keep a small percentage and then you'll remit back to the publisher the balance.
That's our current thinking, but we don't know the exact numbers at this point.
Right.
So.
Obviously this would work for any book, not just poetry, where the design elements were critical, I assume.
That's right. In fact, we put other kinds of books on into the prototype apps, and they work just fine. But we really want to do more. We really want to serve the poetry market, at least to start. And so we're really focusing on that.
But it could also be the any scholarly book that writes about poetry or quotes at length from designed books that have, or pages that have some kind of important design element.
That's true, yep.
Which would be probably a good corollary market for you.
Yep.
What do you see, you know, in the, I guess I want to talk a little bit about, you know, we have a limited time left, but I want to talk a little bit about how you see the further evolution of not just your business, but I guess your business in the context of the evolving evolution for publishing as it affects your client base, which is primarily still independent publishers and academic presses. Or I guess you have trade clients as well. But the question, I guess, is, you know, how do you see the business evolving in terms of the mix of different, you know, just what becomes the predominant form for people to read in?
I think that the electronic forms will become more refined and hopefully higher quality. And I think that print will persist, and I think it will depend on the category of book, which dominates. I think that the biggest questions in my mind are the trends I mentioned earlier about those crossing lines when, you know, in certain categories, when if e-books become predominant, then how that affects the economics of the business. That said, I talked to a distributor last week that said that only 2 or 3% of their books are selling as e-books right now. Other people have said as many as 50% of some categories.
Right. Now, I've heard the same thing from certain distributors, that for smaller publishers, the e-book business has not blossomed yet, that
yeah.
It seems to be heading, you know, there's the predominant sale is going following the mass market model, that it's the books, you know, people who read lots and lots of books, which tend to be people who consume lots of romances, lots of popular fiction, even lots of popular nonfiction. Those are kind of the mainstream readers. They're consuming the bulk of e-books. It may also be that there's a certain conservatism about some of the readers of literature who are still sticking with the book, or people who are, I mean, certainly not academics, I would think. You know, they seem to be moving fairly quickly into digital reading, but it does seem, or in, like, surprising areas, that cookbooks have not gone heavily digital yet. That market is still producing artifactual publishing.
Right, right. Well, I think that, you know, part of it is, like with cookbooks, one can think immediately of the obvious applications of multimedia within the cookbook, you know, like how to make an omelet or whatever, a little clip or something like that. But people are still getting their heads around, well, how do we actually produce these things, and what are the economics of producing these more richer kind of books, richer in one sense anyway.
Right.
I don't know. To me, that's actually one of the most exciting areas, is that we're not, I don't think we're limiting the book, we're expanding the book by moving this direction.
Well, it's true, and the fact that there have been very few, relatively few what we call enhanced e-books, says to me that's simply because people are still figuring it out. You know, the comparative that seems apt is looking at television as it was in 1947 or 1948. You know, it was still pretty rudimentary, and TV looked like putting a camera in front of the proscenium of a stage.
Right.
It took a long time, relatively speaking, for people to figure out not only how the technology could work, but what people liked. And what were the creative opportunities that had to evolve before, you know, to get more and more sophisticated and more interesting? So I think that applies to, you know, the world of enhanced ebooks, even the world of what you now might call flat ebooks. You know, there's still a lot of room for innovation. I know, you know, Amazon has announced just the other day they're adding social features to reading on the Kindle. We don't know what that's going to look like, how, you know, whether that changes the way people read or gets more people involved, or maybe only attracts a few people. Nobody really knows.
Right.
Which is great. I mean, it is. It looks like still, you know, I was thinking to what you said about 1998, 1999, I thought e-publishing was going to be the next big thing, and it turned out to be the next big disaster.
Right.
And but now it's 10, 12 years later, what seemed, you know, what obviously happened is that the technology that was necessary to open the market, plus the business that Amazon had built, enabled them to have that platform. But it, you know, all of a sudden, it actually has become a real opportunity. And when you look at if the overall sales of electronic books are under 5% of the market, that means they have a lot of room to grow.
That's true.
So, well, I think what you've done with Ampersand is really, really interesting, and I hope people will be following along. It caused me to learn about Bookmobile, which I did not know about before, so it's been really interesting to talk to you about it here today. And thanks for, you know, thanks for spending the time.
Well, thanks for having me, David.
This has been Publishing Talks. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to Don Leeper of Bookmobile.com. Thank you.